Blog Talk Radio.
There we go. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Stuart Thompson. Welcome to Personal Transformation. Tonight, I'm fortunate enough to have one of our facilitators here as well, Steve. He's a survivor, facilitator now, and also a musician. So
hi,
welcome,
Stuart.
Steve.
Thank you. Thank you. Glad to be here.
So tonight, basically, ladies and gentlemen, it is really, really great treat having Steve here. So I think right off the hop, first off, I got to get this other crap out of the way. I shouldn't call it crap, but it isn't very important. But first off, personal transformation is about peer support only. I'm not a doctor or physician or anything of the sort, but please keep that in mind. And also, basically tonight, we're just going to be talking about Steve, his story, and we're going to throw some songs in, some originals, some covers. That kind of, that's where you're at, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
That's fantastic. So I'm really, really grateful that Steve is here. So we're just going to go right on to it. So Steve, warm us up with one of your songs, please.
Well, thank you. This is a tune of my own composition called One Step Ahead of the Law. I like honky-tonk music. You'll probably be able to tell that pretty fast. When I get to town, I come in on the bus. Keep my head down, not causing any fuss. Like a fly caught in a web, I'll stay calm, won't lose my head. I'm still one step ahead of the law. One step ahead of the law. No girls, no dice, no old-time barroom brawls. One step ahead of the law. Rest my head for just one night and I'll be gone. I ain't here to stay, I'm just passing through. But trouble finds a way, no matter what I do. Well, I used to be the one to do anything for fun, but I'm just one step ahead of the law. One step ahead of the law. No girls, no dice, no old-time barroom brawls. One step ahead of the law. Rest my head for just one night and I'll be gone. When I leave this town, I'll hitch a truck and ride. I may get somewhere if luck is on my side. Well, this truck driving man, he too is on the lam. We'll stay one step ahead of the law. One step ahead of the law. No girls, no dice, no old-time barroom brawls. One step ahead of the law. Rest my head for just one night and I'll be gone. Rest my head for just one night and I'll be gone.
Bravo. Thank you, Steve.
No problem.
Thank you.
Thanks again for having me, Stuart.
Oh, you're welcome. It is my pleasure, for sure. Well, I guess, you know what, let's just dive right into it, you know, Steve?
Yeah.
So I guess I'm going to ask you for your story. To what brought you to the Gatehouse and to where you're at now, if that's good with you.
Yeah, absolutely. I was abused as a child from about the age of 8 to about the age of 12 by a boarder who lived in our house. And I lived in a very tumultuous household. My mother was serious borderline personality disorder, so even before the sexual abuse, the house was just chaos all the time. And I survived it, but it led me to be a very disconnected person. So I would sort of shut down, keep people at arm's length. And as I got older, my coping strategies were less and less effective. And a few years ago, the girl I'm still dating had mentioned she'd had a previous partner who had been abused as a child. And she'd mentioned Gatehouse to him,
mm-hmm.
and he'd come for the intake interview, but never followed through.
Yeah.
And it just kind of, the knowledge of this place just kind of sat in the back of my head for a couple of years. And I just finally hit a point where I didn't want to be disconnected anymore. It was causing troubles in my relationships. I was just getting less and less connected to the world, and I'd had enough. So I finally looked up the Gatehouse number and called, and had an intake interview here, which was great. And and I started coming last year. It was around May of last year. I took those 5 steps up the front door.
Yes.
Which,
oh, yeah. Always talk about those stairs.
Yeah, the longest short staircase in the world.
It's gotta be, yeah.
And ever since, my life has just been improving. So I did my phase one here and had a couple of great facilitators. And I really had some aha moments going through the program. And I realized how incredibly disconnected I'd been. And I just, the ability to share the story with a group of people who it didn't scare off. In fact, you're sharing your story with other survivors. So
that actually can relate.
That, so as you're talking about it, there people are nodding like, yep, I understand that. And then they would share their stories and you're like, I get it. And, you know, so the journey really started with feeling not alone with it anymore. You know,
I can really appreciate that because that was the biggest thing I felt when I came, before I came here, was I was alone. I thought I was alone, but I was so wrong on that. But I'm sorry to continue on.
Oh, no problem. It's well, when I was in the middle of the abuse, I'd actually told my family doctor and was basically told, oh, we don't talk about that stuff, and was just sort of set back into that environment. So, you know, it sort of taught me to keep my mouth shut on it. And that's a terrible idea. And this place really taught me otherwise. So the phase one program, you know, really taught me to open up.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it allowed me to, my girlfriend knew that I'd experienced abuse as a child, but she didn't really know any of the details or the extent of it, anything like that.
Not that you would talk about it anyway, right? Other than you admitted that you've been through.
Yeah, I'd mentioned that I had, and she'd always been supportive, but I just wasn't capable at the time of sharing details. And, so phase one really allowed me to open up. And then at the end of phase one, my facilitator mentioned I should take the facilitator training. So I did that in the break in between and went into the phase two, which was, you know, phase one is a lot of finding your own voice and, you know, connecting to yourself again. And then phase two is a bit more work, right?
Yeah,
phase two is
a lot more work.
Okay, so now you know you're messed up. So what are you going to do about it, right?
Thank you for saying it that way. That's exactly what it is.
Yeah. So and I had a really great facilitator for phase two, and very provocative questions, and like didn't take shallow answers, like pushed for more depth, and it really taught me a lot of great new coping mechanisms that I just didn't have beforehand. And, you know, it's really changed my life. I feel like a completely different person.
Oh, no doubt you do.
I just don't disconnect like I used to. My relationship with my girlfriend is 1,000 times better. You know, she's a very intuitive person, and she could really sense when
you're feeling off.
She could sense when I was feeling off, but when I disconnected, I wouldn't show it outwardly.
Yeah. And you put up a wall, right?
Yeah. So the disconnect between how she knew I was feeling and the front I was putting out would make her feel really uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm.
So now I'm much more open. I'm much more comfortable with being vulnerable, you know. And I have good days and bad days, but on the bad days I can admit, hey, I'm having a bad day. And it's okay. You know, we've gone through these really traumatic experiences. So we are going to feel some grief and some sadness and some anger. And it's okay to feel those feelings, just you can't let them own you.
Mm-hmm.
So I still have a long way to go, but I think personal growth never ends for any of it.
Whether you've been abused or not, personal growth is always there.
Yeah. And so then after I finished my phase two, I was invited to become a facilitator. And so I'm 2 weeks away from finishing up first phase one group, which has been a great experience as well. It's been nice to give back, but being a facilitator is, you know, it's still a journey for me as well.
So what does transformation mean to you now, that now you've gone this far?
I feel now like I actually have some control over my life. So so far the transformation has been from a place where my emotions and my anger and my disappointment would control my behavior. Now I feel much more in control of my own behavior. And while I still have those emotions, they have a more reasonable place in my life.
I still feel those things, but they don't control my behavior anymore. So, and I'm slowly discovering who I am. I was so disconnected for so long that I didn't really know who I was.
So your personal identity, and that's where I can totally relate to that, because I've always said, and I've been very, very open about this throughout the whole time I've been doing this web radio stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And even not off, I mean, I'm very, very open about finding myself, who I was.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a really, really big task for me, because I think about, I held on to this secret for almost 50 years.
Mm-hmm.
And then bang, I started talking about it. But at the same time, even prior to me started talking about it, I really didn't know who I was. Yeah, I'm Stuart, but who?
Mm-hmm.
But my identity, who am I? What am I about? What is it about me? What makes me tick? Who I am?
Mm-hmm.
And that was a hard part, trying to figure that out.
Yeah, I was always, because of the tumultuous household I grew up in.
Yeah.
I was always managing other people's emotions and trying to meet their needs and trying to keep things on an even keel. And my own needs were so far down the list of priorities that I'm still not 100% sure what they are. But one of the nice things about this transformation is I'm starting to discover my own needs and my own desires and what I want out of my life. And up until I came to the gatehouse, I lived a day at a time. I didn't really have much of a vision for the future. It just, each day was a struggle, and I felt good when I made it to the end of the day. And I didn't spend much time thinking beyond that. And now I'm starting to figure out what I want out of the rest of my life. I feel like this is a new beginning for me.
So within saying that, and then I'm going to ask you to jump to another song.
Mm-hmm.
So is there anything that's really outstanding that you've discovered about yourself that you never really put much thought to prior to you coming here?
As
far as you being a man and your own personal identity?
I think... That's a tough question.
Yeah, sorry.
No, it's good. Yeah. Bring them. The tough questions are good. Most of the stuff I used to do, even playing music, which has been such a salvation for me.
Yeah, which we're going to dive into a little bit more.
Yeah.
Yeah.
A lot of it was about avoidance.
Okay.
So, I would play music because I could get on stage and I could separate myself from my life and from everybody else.
Mm.
So I could be in a social environment, but distant from everybody.
Mm.
And now that I've gone through this process and I've begun this sort of transformative journey, I feel more connected to the things I'm doing. So I'd taken a break from performing live for a while to sort of get my head around this new me.
Yeah.
But now when I perform, I feel much more connected. So although from the outside it may look very similar, from the inside, I'm enjoying it a lot more than I used to. And it's driven less by, I'm not running away from something anymore. I feel now like I'm walking towards something.
Yeah.
I feel like I'm not running away anymore. I think that's been a key message for me.
Wow, that's really great, Steve, because... You know, it's funny you say it like that, because that's kind of like how I look at it with myself.
Mm-hmm.
Because basically, and there's still some, I'd be lying to say that there's still some things I don't run away from. But for the most part, I'm grounded, I'm here, and as something comes up, for the most part, I face it right on.
Mm-hmm.
As before, I was gone.
Mm-hmm.
I really appreciate that. So thank you. So what are you going to sing for us now?
Well, this one, it actually ties into a great story about how disconnected I was. So this is a song by a beautiful musical couple, Fred Squire and Kate Mackey.
Okay.
So I'd met Kate Mackey. I used to support a lot of singer-songwriters who would play at the Free Times Cafe on College Street.
On College Street, yeah.
I met a woman and I played some bass with her. I'm an upright bass player primarily.
Uh-huh.
And when I'd play a show with her, I'd meet two other singer-songwriters who'd ask me to play with them. And so I spent about a year and a half as a fairly regular bass player at that club. And I'd met Kate Mackey there and played with her and sort of, helped her connect to the Toronto music scene.
Mm-hmm.
But I was so disconnected that it didn't sort of sit in my long-term memory. So years later, I was living and working at the Cameron House in mm-hmm. Toronto.
Yep.
And I had the night off, so I'd come downstairs to see who was playing, and Kate and Fred Squire, who independently were great musicians, but had come together and were performing together. And I watched them play, and it just was mind-blowingly beautiful. And I went up and introduced myself afterwards, and Kate was like, I know you. We did all that stuff with the Freak Hive. And it really hit me because I didn't remember any of it.
Didn't remember
any of it. That I was so disconnected from the world around me that even though we'd spent that time together 10 or 15 years prior, it was just gone. And she was very nice, and she was like, you know, she wasn't offended that I didn't initially remember her. But it really sunk into me that how deep my disconnection had been, that I'd forgotten. And so they were selling this 45. So yeah. it was two songs they'd written and performed together. And I went upstairs and put it on, and it's two of the most beautiful songs I've ever heard. So it's not going to be as beautiful when I do it, but I'm going to play a song of theirs that really struck a chord with me. Most of my music is very lighthearted, as you heard from the first song. But this is a sadder song. So I'm going to play it for you. All at once, the world will be ended. All at once, everything in the world will seem so clear. And everything you did and everything you thought and everything you broke and everything you bought will be gone. Away. But this morning I woke up with a smile, and I laughed the whole day through. I'm a happy man, as far as I can tell. I'm a happy kind of man. This morning I woke up all alone, and I may never find a home. I'm a lost man, as far as I can tell. I'm a lost kind of man. Maybe I should waste away each day, 'cause the place I live is made of gray clouds, static in the sky. I'm a happy man on a stage. All at once, the world ended. All at once, everything in the world became so clear. And everything I did and everything I thought and everything I broke and everything I bought had gone away.
Thank you.
No problem.
Great. Well, so a while ago when we were talking prior to being on here, you mentioned you kind of had to work your way into it. You had to spend some time.
Mm-hmm.
Just to find your voice, even for singing.
Mm-hmm.
So tell us a little bit about that, and is it related to, and do you think it's any way related to what happened to you as a child?
Oh, absolutely. I've been a bass player primarily my whole life, and one of the things that appealed to me about playing bass was I could play music and I could be on stage,
mm-hmm.
but I could stay small.
Yeah.
I could stay back in the corner.
That's right.
And not be a center of attention.
Yeah.
And I could do my thing, but be left alone. And, you know, the lead singer and the guitar player, they get sort of all the glory.
Yeah, all the glory.
And I love playing bass, but a large part of it was my desire to keep my life small and to stay beneath notice, right? Growing up again in such a crazy household, not being noticed was better than being noticed, because being noticed caused trouble. Mm-hmm. So the desire to stay small was strong. So for years, you know, finding music was a salvation. I mean, it was a way I could lift myself out of myself and keep myself alive, you know? And then I hit a point, I guess this was probably 7 or 8 years ago, where, you know, I have two siblings who were quite damaged by the environment we grew up in. Mm-hmm. And my brother had attempted suicide, and we'd had a really tumultuous time. And he was dating my best friend, who I was living with, so I just backed away from the whole situation. And I really hit sort of a rock bottom point. So I was just living in a room by myself, and I was going to work every day, working alone, coming home, spending time alone, and I just realized I needed to do something to shake myself out of this rut. And so I decided I've been a musician for years, and I'd never sung. My voice was silent, and there's no way that wasn't related to the abuse. There's no way that the fact that I felt like my voice wasn't worth sharing was a direct result of that. And I decided it was time my voice was heard. So I'd come home from work every night, and I would sit in my room. I bought myself a cheap guitar, and I started playing and learning how to sing. And I played Dead Flowers by the Rolling Stones.
Which you're going to sing for us today?
Yeah. I must have played that song 25 times, 30 times a night, every night for about 6 months. And it helped me find my voice. And I don't think it was any accident that has eventually led me to the Gatehouse and mm-hmm. finding my voice in an even deeper level. And it's been a delight. It's been great to be able to go out. I love playing bass still. I love to be in a band and play bass and back people up. But I enjoy going out with my baritone ukulele and doing some of my own shows now and writing some songs, which is something I had never done. Because, again, my voice was, you know, it was better to lie low than it was to put my voice out there. And it's been a real transformation being able to put my voice out in public. And I think being able to get over that hurdle and learn how to sing has been, you know, was the beginning of this journey that led me to the Gatehouse, right? And the beginning of finding, like a literal finding of my voice.
Fantastic. So before I get you to dive into another song, tell me about your experience. Now, you facilitated for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
Now, has that affected you in any way? And if so, how so?
It's definitely affected me. I mean, one of the big things is, you know, going into a room with, like, I've been around the Gatehouse for a year now, and I've had a choice. I've had a chance to find my voice and get a little more comfortable with myself. And it's easy to underestimate how far you've come,
mm-hmm.
right? Especially when the journey ahead looks really long.
Yeah, it's really long, yeah.
But you come in and you sit down as a facilitator and you see these brave, brave men who walked in the house for the first time, the first night, first group. And you see the nervousness and you see how emotionally contained and the walls are up. And it was a real revelation of, like, that was me a year ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd come in to do the facilitating, and I just casually walked in the door of the Gatehouse. Like, I felt like I was coming home.
That's
there
right.
there were no nerves. There was no, you know, I felt really comfortable here. This is a really safe, welcoming place. And seeing the guys come in, especially the first couple of sessions, it really struck me how far I'd come. Because I was in the same place they were a year ago. And just the opportunity to give back to the Gatehouse mm-hmm. and to help other guys find their voice. And, you know, we've all gone through this experience in common, but our stories are all so varied. And the ways we've dealt with it so different. So I feel really privileged to be able to hear the stories of these other men who've gone through this. And, you know, I learn something from them every night. I mean, one of the joys of the Gatehouse is, you know, there are no, you know, this isn't a counselor and a group of patients.
No.
You know, this is a group of messed up people. The men who walk in here for the first time, and to realize that it sinks home to me how much bravery it took for me to walk in the door. You know, we tend to belittle our accomplishments as survivors of abuse. We tend to downplay our successes and highlight our failures.
Or how, we definitely do.
And coming in and facilitating has really, you know, I feel some pride as to how far I've come. And it's humbling because I realize how much further I have to go still. But it's gone from a terrifying journey to kind of an exciting one. You know, I'm unearthing who I really am for the first time. I mean, I'm 45 years old in a few weeks. And I spent all this time not really knowing who I was. And now it feels like a rebirth. You know, and now I'm actually starting to discover who I am.
It's funny you say a rebirth, because that's how I was on social media just a few days ago, and this lady, actually, she's a rapper. I didn't hear her a few weeks ago from British Columbia, Jody, or Baby Girl, if you know her on Twitter.
Mm-hmm.
And I was talking to her, she was reading my story, and I said, well, and she made a comment about my voice. And I said, well, yeah, thank you for reading my story. And now I have my voice has been basically reborn.
Mm-hmm.
That's how I make an analogy of it. I just basically been reborn. This is who I am now.
Mm-hmm.
And now I can't stop. But it's funny. Well, I'm saying funny. It's rather profound how when I really think about it, all those years that I've kept myself quiet, and this is how I can sort of relate so well to what you're talking about, especially when you talk about the singing. I kind of done the same thing myself for many, many years.
Mm-hmm.
And then I got back into it again, and then I did it for a while. I got involved in a couple of bands, and I was singing, and I thought I was doing all right, but then for some reason I just went back into my shell.
Right.
I found the attention to be too much,
mm-hmm.
and I never was a person for being the center of stage. It just wasn't me. I'm not ego-driven or anything of that sort, so I found it really hard, so I basically go back into my shell again.
Mm-hmm.
But when I hear people like yourself talking and your journey to where you are, and now I'm kind of emotionally charged about it, because I know with my roommate, he's a musician as well.
Mm-hmm.
And now we're talking about doing the same thing, like he's a drummer,
right?
So and we get all the instruments, we get everything, keyboards, everything, right? So we're seriously talking about doing that as well. So when I hear you talking about your story, I can really, really, really appreciate you talking.
Mm-hmm. Well, I hope you do as well. It's a very powerful thing to find your voice.
Yeah, very much so, very much so. And when I think about all those years, I basically just kept quiet and didn't say nothing. And I just agree with what you're saying. There's not a doubt about that. You know, and I think about it now, how I found my voice, kind of like what I'm doing here now. And I public speak and I do this and I do that. And I found my voice again. It's basically, I guess, what I'm kind of trying to say. And more ways than one.
Mm-hmm.
So I probably will do what I'm talking about. I'm probably going to go back and do it. I've wanted to get back and singing again. I've just always been hiding in the background there. So I probably will be doing it very soon.
No doubt about that.
And maybe we can collaborate some way in that way as well sometime.
I'd love to.
So bring me some flowers.
Yeah, let's do it. I haven't sung this one in a while. Ironically, like I said, I played it 30 times a night for about 6 months, but let's see if I get all the way through this one. Well, when you're sitting there in your silk upholstered chair, talking to some rich folks that you know, I hope you don't see me and my ragged company. You know I could never be alone.
take me down, little Susie, take me down. I know you think you're the queen of the underground, but you can send me dead flowers every morning. Send me dead flowers by the mail. Send me dead flowers to my wedding. And I won't forget to put roses on your grave. Well, when you're sitting back in your rose pink Cadillac, making bets on Kentucky Derby Day, I'll be in my basement room with a needle and a spoon and another girl to take my brain away. Take me down, little Susie, take me down. I know you think you're the queen of the underground, but you can send me dead flowers every morning. Send me dead flowers by the mail. Send me dead flowers to my wedding. And I won't forget to put roses on your grave. And I won't forget to put roses on your grave.
Bravo. Thank you, Steve. Thank you.
That takes me back.
I love that song, too. You did a great rendition of it.
Thank you. Takes me back to a very difficult time.
Oh, no doubt. Yeah. I can totally relate to that. Same thing here myself.
Yeah.
And, you know, we talk about music now. So you explained how you kind of were held back in your shell, but yet you wanted to still be part of it. And I mean, even being backstage, well, not backstage, but being on stage and playing the bass and that.
Mm-hmm.
So has music, tell me how music, I'm just trying to, I want to make sure I phrase this question properly, but Tim, now, how does it affect you when you're feeling down, and how does it affect you when you're feeling up? I mean, that's kind of one extreme to the next.
Right. Well, one of the things I've always loved about music is when I'm feeling down, playing music brings me back into myself, you know? And I mean, I talked about how I could use it as a distancing tool.
Yeah.
Right. But at the same time, it's very difficult for me to play music and not be in my body, right? So I find when I'm down, if I pick up an instrument and play, it brings me back into myself. Like it helps me center myself.
Mm.
And then when I'm feeling up, it's just such a joyous experience. I just can't think of a better way to celebrate being alive than singing a song I've always felt that, you know, we've turned music into sort of a spectator sport where somebody gets up on stage and everybody else stands back and watches. And the last band I was in was a really participatory band. So we did a lot of old country songs and songs you could sing along to. And one of the things I really loved about that band was we really brought the audience into the experience. And I've always been the kind of guy who manages the emotions of the people around me. I'm mm-hmm. always really concerned that everybody's on an even keel and not feeling anything negative, because that was always a danger sign around my head. So while that in itself was a negative thing, the ability to read people's emotions and the ability to bring people together into a shared emotional space is a powerful skill.
Oh, it
I mean, it's actually, you know, if I can put it this way, it's quite a positive outcome from a very negative experience. So I find that, you know, when I'm on stage, I have an ability to bring people together into this shared emotional space, which to me is really the goal of music, right? Music, when you go and see somebody play, you should have an emotional reaction to it. And I feel like I wouldn't be as capable at doing it without the experiences I've had.
Yeah, that's fantastic. I totally get what you're saying. Now, now moving forward, now how do you look at it? Pretty much the same way now that you've transformed to where you are now, or is that whole picture you described changed?
Oh, it's definitely changed. I mean, I think I mentioned this earlier. It used to be a way I could run away from dealing with my life. So once you get on stage, the show is everything, and your own personal whatever is irrelevant. The show, you know, the show must go on, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it was, in some ways, it was a great way to sort of disconnect myself from life and be apart from it. And the same, I did a lot of touring, and that's, you know, it appealed to the side of me that was very disconnected. I could get, you know, I toured with the band quite a bit. And then when the band broke up, I did a bunch of tours across Canada on the Greyhound. And while they were great experiences, you know, it played into my feeling of disconnection. So I could get on a bus and I could spend a month sleeping on people's couches. You know, you show up in a town, you play, you get to superficially know a bunch of people, and then you get to run away the next morning and go to the next town. So, you know, that part of the experience is definitely changing for me. So I've taken a bit of time off from having a band or doing touring, and I'm approaching it in a much more mindful way. So now I want to get on stage because I love to perform, not because I'm running away from my problem, right? And when I tour, I want to tour because I want to spread the joy rather than running away again from my own problems and my own issues. And so it's been interesting. I've started to dig into writing some more songs, and, you know, I think there may be a few serious songs in me. All of the songs I've written are relatively tongue-in-cheek, which is, you know, is genuine, and I'm never going to stop writing those songs. I think there's a lot of serious music out there, and I think the world could use some lighthearted songs.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm less afraid to be vulnerable. So I'm really interested to see how that impacts my songwriting.
Yeah. So your experience here at the Gatehouse has changed you or transformed you,
mm-hmm.
your abilities of writing songs into a whole kind of different realm now.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I'm less afraid of expressing sadness and mm-hmm. anger and
joy.
So I'll still continue to write joyous songs that will make people chuckle, you know, I feel like my range will expand
mm-hmm.
now that those aren't the only feelings I can put out there. Right now, I feel much more comfortable singing a sad song, like the Fred Squire, Kate Mackey song.
Yeah.
You know, that's the kind of song I would aspire to write myself one day. And this transformative experience has definitely changed it. And it changes the way it feels to me to play. So while playing would bring me into my body, it wouldn't necessarily connect me with the world around me. And now I feel more connected. So the experience, even I've gone and played a few open mics over the last few months, and the experience has been quite different. I don't feel apart from people. I feel more connected.
More connected.
And the audience reaction is different because of it.
Yeah. I can imagine with you. Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Because most musicians I've seen over the years and been around, and I'm not talking about just here in Canada, but in the U.S. too, in some cities there I've gone, like Chicago and New York. And I've seen such a wide range of musicians over the years, and talked to many different musicians over the years, and it's amazing how each one of them, obviously they have their own identities and how they
mm-hmm.
do, but it's amazing how they all connect in their own little way.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, some of it's really weird, and some of it's really, really great, but for the most part, it's just interesting to see how they connect with people, and how they get their audiences to connect with them, and partake. Either they sit there like lumps, like a lump on a log, or
mm-hmm.
they're participating with whoever's performing.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just amazing to see the diversity of the different musicians,
mm-hmm.
you know, that I've seen. It's just actually pretty incredible.
Yeah. Well, I think many musicians, especially the ones who stick it out for many years,
mm-hmm.
you know, I think most of us have been slightly damaged in some way, if I can use
oh, yeah.
that terminology,
oh, yeah.
right?
Yeah.
And I think music is a way of hanging on, and is a way of finding joy and connection when, you know, our natural ability to do that has been suppressed by our experiences.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a desire to have those experiences, even though we're not very good at it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think for a lot of musicians, it's a way of reaching out from this place of, you know, this damaged place, this place of an inability to express those things, maybe face to face or in a one-on-one social environment.
Mm.
But when you take it into a musical realm, it becomes easier to do, right? It, like I said, music, if it weren't for music, I would have disappeared years ago. I would have just completely disconnected. I probably would be sleeping on a street corner somewhere. And I'm dead serious about that.
Oh, yeah. No, I totally get what you're saying, because I've done the same thing myself.
Yeah. Yeah. And music has kept me...
grounded in its own way.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm really excited to see how it changes going forward now that music is something I can embrace not as an escape, but as a part of my journey.
As part of your journey.
I'm really curious to see how
I'm really happy you say that, because that's very, very important.
Mm-hmm.
You know, especially going somebody who's going through this process. And, I mean, not just for music, but for anything, right? I mean,
yeah.
to sort of find some kind of connection with something, even a relationship,
mm-hmm.
Whether it be with an intimate partner or a friendship, but to be connected with something. And that's what most of us survivors do, is we disconnect.
Mm-hmm.
And to find that initial connection with somebody is profoundly wonderful.
Mm-hmm. And it's been interesting. Music was one of the only ways I would connect with other people.
Mm.
And since my journey through the Gatehouse, I've been branching out. You know, we talk a lot about the inner child.
Yes.
And
yeah.
because of my upbringing, you know, my house, even before the abuse, I didn't really get much of a childhood. You know, I was sort of the small adult, because there were no functioning adults in my household. So somebody had to take that role. So from as long ago as I can remember, I took on the role of the adult in the room, even when I was 3-4 years old. So exploring the idea of the inner child here, you know, I got back into playing board games, right? It was something I enjoyed as a teenager, because it was a way of connecting with other people. And I got back into it as a direct result of the Gatehouse. And I've met other people, and I now have a weekly, every Tuesday night, I have friends over, we play board games. It's a social connection that I haven't had for a long time.
So, by the way, what kind of board games do you guys play?
All kinds of sort of contemporary. I have one of my favorites. There's like a Star Wars dogfighting game.
Where
You know, you have ships from Star Wars, and you fly around and shoot each other down. And it's funny. So there's some gaming stores in Toronto, and they have every Friday night people get together at the stores and play this Star Wars game.
Wow, I didn't know that.
And so I, for weeks, I'd wanted to go. And I was like, oh, I'm going to be the old man in the room, and it's going to be weird. And then I finally, thanks to the Gatehouse, just sucked it up and went. Because if it didn't work, it didn't work. And I got there, and I wasn't the oldest guy there. In fact, the age range of people playing this game is like 30 to 50. Because those are the people who love Star Wars. Like,
yeah.
we were the ones who
were
7, 10, 12 years old when
yeah.
Star Wars first came
exactly.
out.
Exactly.
And it's been a joyous reconnection to a childhood that, well, it's not even necessarily reconnection. It's a joyous new childhood
yeah.
that I never really had before. So one of the things Gatehouse has done is allowed me to, you know, music was sort of the one lifeline I had to the rest of the world. But part of this transformative journey is realizing there are other ways for me to connect with the world as well. So it's helped me expand my palette of ways to connect with other people.
It's a little bit off, but you must be a little bit excited about the new Star Wars movie coming out with almost the original cast.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I cannot wait for that either.
Well, and the director, I mean, he what he did with, because he did the reboot of the Star Trek.
That's
series,
right.
And they were great.
Yeah.
So I'm quite excited after the disappointing prequels.
Yeah.
I'm quite excited to see what he does with one of the things. So Christmas was always a really difficult time for me because it was.
I can appreciate that too. Totally.
It was, it was just drama and self-harm and just, it was over the top of my head. And so for many years after I'd left home, I basically ignored Christmas. So it's funny you mentioned the Star Wars movie. So one of the things, so my girlfriend and I, because she's not a big Christmas fan either,
mm-hmm.
We've developed our own little rituals at Christmas time. So we, you know, the city is abandoned on Christmas Day.
Pretty much.
So we go walking in the snow. We go see a movie, and then we go out for Chinese food. And that's how we celebrate Christmas now. And so it's very exciting. The last few years, we've gone to see the Hobbit movies.
Yes.
And they had the last one last Christmas.
Yeah.
And they've announced that this Christmas is the Star Wars movie. So.
Oh, okay. I didn't realize that.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's coming out, like, late December.
Oh, okay.
So it's very exciting for me. It ties into my new, like, we've developed
a new
way of celebrating Christmas that's disconnected from all that troubled past.
You know, it's funny you're talking about Christmas. I really, really tried. And, I mean, some years I've done better than others, but I've just struggled with it for so long,
mm-hmm.
you know, and I really want to get past that, but I just, because I think of some of my most awful triggers or actually flashbacks are falling back to my abuse mode through Christmas.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and I've been trying to shake that for as long as I can remember.
Yeah. Well, that was, you know, for many years I just ignored Christmas.
Yeah.
And, mm-hmm. but now, you know, reinventing it. Has been a real delight for me. So it's not about giving presents. It's not about family because I don't talk to my family anymore. It's about walking through an empty city, seeing a movie that's exciting to me, and then eating so much Chinese food that I feel like exploding.
Right.
And it's a very different thing. So it's not, we don't have a Christmas tree. I still can't stand the sound of Christmas music. But we've invented a completely new holiday on our own terms, and that's really helped me. And so now it's so funny you mentioned the Star Wars movie, because it's not off topic at all. It's actually, I'm excited about this upcoming Christmas because I get to do my own version of it, and I get to go see the new Star Wars movie.
Yeah, I'll probably end up doing the exact same thing.
Yeah.
I'll end up doing the exact same thing. So how about singing another song?
Yeah, I could do that. let's see. Well, one of the things, so, you know, we've talked about this in the group I've been facilitating,
yes.
Struggles with faith.
Okay, yes.
And so one of the things that I've dealt with in my songwriting is approaching issues of faith with a bit of humor. And so I wrote a song, I went to the Hillside Festival, and I had some time alone around the campsite, and this song just came to me. Like in one big nugget, like some songs you struggle with for weeks and some just go bam, and they're right there. So I wrote a kind of a funny gospel song called The Angel's Lament.
Okay.
So it goes a little something like this. Never repent
when you reach the end. Well, I ain't had a drink since the day I got here. To tell you the truth, well, I've shed a few tears. Bet my friends are drunk on the devil's good cheer. While I'm stuck in heaven without any beer. So never repent when you reach the end. If the devil's made deals with all of your friends, well, I'm all alone in this warning I send. Never repent when you reach the end.
Bravo. Thank you, Steve.
No problem.
So, where do you see Steve in the future?
Oh, that's a good question. Well, first of all, I see a Steve in the future, which is
that's great.
Very new. Like I said, for many years, life was a daily struggle, and thinking beyond that particular bedtime was just too much. So now I've been thinking about a lot of things. I've been contemplating yet another career change. I started out as I came out of university and I ended up working as an executive assistant in the finance industry for about almost 10 years. And I didn't like it. I didn't like the people. I didn't like the attitudes. I didn't like the goals of the organization I worked for. And so eventually I left and started doing renovation and construction work. And I've been doing that for about 12 years now. But, you know, I'm starting to get a little bit older, and I don't want to be hauling bags of cement when I'm 60. So I've started to think about what I would really like to do in an ideal world. So I've actually been teaching myself 3D animation. There's some open source software called Blender.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been putting a few hours a day in learning how to model and animate 3D stuff. And it's something I think I would like to eventually pursue for money. So I still have, you know, I still have a year or so of learning to do before I can start putting a portfolio out there. But it's something I'd like to, for once, I'd like to have a career I didn't fall into, but one I chose.
Mm-hmm.
And that's definitely part of my future plan. I've always wanted to have a boat. You know, but I've never had a plan for the future. So it's always been just kind of this vague dream in the back of my head. And now I've been doing a lot of work over at the Toronto Marina, and I've gotten to know a lot of boat owners, and I've done a lot of work on other people's boats. So I have sort of a 5-year plan to build my own houseboat.
Mm-hmm.
And
Get
myself a slip at the marina.
Yeah.
It's a great environment. It's like a little small town environment that's, you know, it's like having a cottage 20 minutes away from the city, you know, on the water.
Yeah.
And now that I can envision myself in the future, I'm sort of slowly working towards, you know, and I'd love to build my own. I'd love to build myself a little houseboat. So every job I do, I stash away the extra lumber and, you know, and I'm working on other people's boats to learn all the different
tricks.
All the tricks of the trade, and I see myself, you know, growing a lot emotionally in the future as well. I mean, I've come a long way in the last year, and it's hard to overstate how different I feel now than I did a year ago.
Well, I can really appreciate that. I'm speaking for myself as well.
Yeah,
it's I know I'm not the same person I used to be.
No,
at all, and. And the great thing about my journey, like yours, as you're talking about, is that it just keeps expanding and expanding and expanding.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things I did for myself, just to make it easier on myself, and maybe you can appreciate this too, is I really didn't put any expectations other than I wanted to heal.
Mm-hmm.
And whatever else happens after the fact, well, then that to me is just gravy, right?
Yeah.
It's kind of like it's maybe kind of funny the way I put it, but that's basically what it is to me. Because
mm-hmm.
one, I like gravy for one thing. but it is. It's been a very interesting journey, and what's transformed for myself to what I am now, just exactly like you're talking about. And one of the biggest things I kind of think I was kind of saying this to you, actually when I did the Sacred Path with you with your group there last week, it's not that, you know, in my journey of transformation, you know, it's so easy. We're so hard on ourselves,
mm-hmm.
you know, and we're probably our own worst critics as far as whether we've done good or whether we've done bad. But mostly we only think of our bad and not think of our good.
Mm-hmm.
We don't emphasize on our good often enough.
Mm-hmm.
And with my transformation, I've learned to do that a little bit. I don't have a high ego. I consider myself to be a very humble person. And I'm still have a hard time with praise from other people.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a hard time even praising myself. But that is slowly starting to change. And at least now when somebody pays me gratitude, at least I'm courteous enough to respect that and thank them for it versus tell them to take a short walk or pop. I'd rather take a long walk on a short beer, right?
Yeah, yeah.
I'm being very nice right now. You know, I could be cussing right now like a trucker, but I won't. So,
yeah, yeah.
But keeping it civil for the folks that are listening. But nonetheless, it's, you know, being able to find yourself in that manner, you know, just for even something like that, it's so simple. It's rather daunting for me for the longest time.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, even taking gratitude from somebody else, like, I thought it was just a whole bunch of hogwash.
Yeah.
You know, how can, you know, like, something's just something. You don't need to thank me for something like that.
Yeah.
You know? But now I see what it's about.
Mm-hmm.
But it certainly makes you think, that's for sure. I do a lot more thinking now when it comes to stuff like that. Not that I'm looking for praise or anything like that. Just the fact that, or rather, let me rephrase that to my own accomplishments, to where I was and where I am now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's easy to get caught up in everything and forget about that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and then when somebody points it out to you, you go, oh, the great thing about it now is I don't get offended anymore.
Yeah. Well, one of the things I've learned is, you know, you mentioned that we're our own worst critic.
That's right.
So when I'm in a bad moment, which I still have plenty of,
oh, yeah.
I take a moment to be mindful. And one of the things I think to myself is, how would you treat somebody else who came to you in this state, right? Because I would never treat anybody else as badly as I've treated myself,
mm-hmm.
not in a million years. So one of the ways I've learned to treat myself better is to imagine, like, what would you do for somebody else? If somebody else came to you and said, I'm feeling this today, right? Instead of using my old coping mechanisms or beating up on myself, like, I would never look at somebody and say, why are you so weak? Why can't you just get over it? I would never in a million years say that to somebody else. So it really helps me to imagine that I'm a human being like everybody else, and I deserve the same kind of treatment that I would give others. And I found that's really helped me, that moment of mindfulness of, like, well, if somebody else came to me saying, I feel really down today and I feel like I'm really stuck, I would be really supportive to somebody else. So it's helped me to be supportive to myself. You know, and just imagining that I'm as worthy of love and attention as anybody else. And it sounds so simple, but it's such a big journey for those of us who've been abused to get to that place.
Oh, huge. Yeah, and you know, a lot of people just wouldn't understand that. And
mm-hmm.
and kind of like you said there, I mean, I know that being brought up, I was brought up that just basically to shut up and put my chin up and take it like a man, and that's it.
Mm-hmm.
Which I'm so confused about today. Like, shut up about what? Well, I know what I have to shut up about, but I don't get why I had to shut up.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm still kind of so bothered by that whole concept about shutting up.
Yeah.
So I shut up for a long time, and what did it get me? It got me, you know, the point where I wanted to, you know, not be around anymore. And I don't trust anybody. I don't trust myself. I can't have any friends. I just can't integrate into society to the way that, well, whatever the hell the norm is, you know, to any degree or level.
Yeah.
And even now, I still kind of wonder about that. But nevertheless, I can do all those things now, as before I couldn't. But just getting there was a real, real task in itself.
Yeah.
And trying not to I try not to put too much ahead of myself, rather than just kind of like I was saying to you earlier, just kind of let things happen mm-hmm. as they may,
mm-hmm.
you know, as long as it's within my threshold, if I can put it that way, right?
Yeah.
and then things will be fine.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's so easy to fall back and think about stuff and to think it over and to catastrophize it and to beat it up and beat yourself up.
Mm-hmm.
And stay with that.
Yeah.
But the great thing is about my journey, and I'm sure maybe you can appreciate this as well, now that I've discovered, well, I don't have to do that anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And furthermore, I was doing it all these years, and what did it get me other than feeling lousy?
Yeah. Yeah, and it's so easy to, you know, we get so comfortable with our coping mechanisms that learning to deal with the world in a different way can be really unnerving. It's very frightening. Even though our old coping mechanisms are not doing what we'd like them to. Mm-hmm. In fact, they're often, as we get older, they end up doing the opposite of what, you know, these things, we learn to do these things because they help us survive during the abuse. But once the abuse is over, it's very hard to let those coping mechanisms go. Like my disconnection, you know, it was without that ability to disconnect, the abuse would have been very hard to survive. But now I'm so many years removed from that abuse, that disconnection doesn't serve any positive purpose at all. It just interferes with my ability to relate to the world and to discover myself and to enjoy life. And, you know, even though we know that's true, it can be really difficult to work past those coping mechanisms and find something new. And so, and again, I appreciate what you're saying about not putting undue pressure on ourselves as we're going through this healing journey.
So did you not find, though, before you started this journey that you would do that to yourself, or you would put more on yourself than you can?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I couldn't say no to anybody. I mean, I've hearing so many stories around the gatehouse, we as survivors, we all have issues around control. So some people seem to go in a direction of just abandoning control, and this is where addictions to drugs and alcohol and all of these things come into play. And then other people go the direction I sort of went, which is too much control, right? So instead of abandoning control, it's not like I haven't faced some addiction problems, but my real addiction was work. You know, I couldn't value myself as a person in so many ways. But if I could go to work and be the best employee ever and be the guy who always said yes and put the most hours in, you know, that was how I got my self-worth. That was how I got my value. And so I was addicted to working. You know, it was my terrible coping mechanism. Instead of dealing with my problems and facing my emotions, I'll just work instead.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, for years, I mean, it kept me housed and fed, which is okay, but it was terrible for my emotional and social life. You know, it's hard to have friendships and relationships when all you do is work, you know, and it left me no time to think about my own life because I didn't want to think about my own life. So part of this journey has been learning to take time for myself.
So with all that you've gone through to where you are now, how does shame have a part of you now? Or it doesn't?
It tries every once in a while to get a hold on me, but it doesn't succeed very well. I used to, you know, I had a great example I shared with the group when we were talking about shame and guilt. So I had an experience where, you know, because doing something wrong when I was a kid, you had to hide it right away. Otherwise, big trouble was coming.
Mm-hmm.
So as an adult, I'd hung on to that habit, even though it was counterproductive. So, and this is going to, it sounds silly, but, you know, I was making dinner and I reached up to the cupboard to grab coconut milk, a can of coconut milk. And what I pulled down was like the can of coconut cream instead.
Yeah.
And I opened it up before I realized what I'd done. And I looked at it, and I had this feeling of terror because I'd opened the wrong can. And so my very first instinct was to dump it, rinse out the can, and hide it at the bottom of the recycling can so nobody knew I'd opened the wrong can of stuff. And I had a moment. I had a mindfulness moment. Like, wait a minute. Like, I'm looking at the lid, at the price sticker that says 89 cents, right? I'm like, I opened the wrong can. I'm human. I'm busy. I'm making dinner. I open the wrong can. There is nothing to be ashamed of. So instead of hiding it from my girlfriend, who wouldn't care, right? Mm-hmm. And I said to her, hey, look, I opened the wrong can. And we had a discussion about how I would have had to hide that before. I would not have been able to help myself. But instead of wasting the can and living in fear and shame,
yeah,
I could dump it into a Tupperware container. I put it in the fridge so we could use it tomorrow, and I moved on, mm-hmm. right? So I've learned to handle it much better, but it still reaches up to try and get me. So the mindfulness, you know, you have to stay mindful mm-hmm. as a survivor, because these old habits will reach out of the darkness and try to grab you.
Yeah,
around something. And again, it sounds so minor, like I opened the wrong 90-cent can of coconut stuff. But it was such a moment of terror for me, the moment I realized, and it was, I was 5 years old again, waiting for the wrath of my parents because I messed up, you know. So there's a lot less shame and guilt in my life than there used to be. But it does rise up occasionally. Mm-hmm. So I still have to be mindful to, you know, to not allow it to take control of me. I have nothing to be ashamed of. Nothing.
Well, thank you for sharing that. And no, and even myself now, I've even come to the realization, and especially more so in the last 6-7 months, you know, shame has been such a huge part of my shaping of who I am. And it's so nice now that I can actually say, you know what, I have no shame no more. I really, you know, and I'll be damned if you're going to give me any shame too, right? I mean, it's both sides. I just refuse to carry it anymore. It's just like, it's wore me out.
Yeah.
And it served me nothing.
Yeah.
Just bad, 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 bad. And, you know, and I refuse to carry it anymore. I just, like you, that's just enough is enough.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll never carry it again. I refuse to.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sticking to my guns.
Good for you.
So how about another song?
Yeah, I'd love to. So there's a songwriter I discovered some years ago named Lee Hazelwood. So he's mostly known, well, he wrote These Boots Are Made for Walking.
Yeah.
Nancy Sinatra song.
Yeah.
And that's the song everybody knows.
Yeah.
But a lot of his own material that he wrote is kind of unknown. And he has an interesting sense of humor that I really appreciate. So he wrote a concept album called A Town Called Trouble. So each song is sung by a character. It's like a Western cowboy frontier town. And each song is sung from the point of view of somebody who lives in the town. And so this song is called Little Flowers. And this is The Undertaker,
mm-hmm.
right, which I really like. So this is Lee Hazelwood.
Cowards and heroes, listen, my friends. If you've got draw money or nothing to spend, it'll make no difference in 100 years or so. 'Cause sooner or later, we all make the little flowers grow. Or later, we all make the little flowers grow. Well, wise men and fools, two will get you five. You'll never get out of this world alive. Some of us stay and some of us go. But sooner or later, we all make the little flowers grow. Or later, we all make the little flowers grow. Well, short men and tall men and all the rest, please don't blame me, I didn't start this mess. Some of us stay and some of us go. But sooner or later, we all make the little flowers grow. Or later, we all make the little flowers grow. Or later, we all make the little flowers grow.
Bravo. Thank you, Steve.
No
That's
problem.
A great song, and I've never heard that song before. At least
yeah.
I don't think so.
Yeah, no. It's a fantastic song.
So, so now, I asked you kind of where you see Steve, but I mean,
mm-hmm.
I guess you're planning on sticking around the gate here for a little while longer?
Oh, absolutely. I'm looking into taking the Phase 2 facilitator training, but I would love to continue to facilitate here. I mean, it's both great to give back and to help other men find their voice. And facilitating is an incredible journey for me as well. So I would love to stick around and continue to be a part of it. I mean, this is an incredible place.
That's great. I know the gatehouse can really use you, that's for sure. Or not you, pardon the way I put that, but you're
really, I appreciate that.
Yeah. So what do you think about the facilitators here? Tell me a little bit about that.
Oh, it's a really interesting collection of unusual people. So, you know, it's such a wild. I mean, that's the thing. Sexual abuse does not discriminate between rich and poor, or
no.
black or white, or tall or short, or you know,
your sexual gender or
yeah, exactly,
or
right. It's
yeah.
there. You know, it's an experience that is like transcends all of those identities. So it's amazing to me to see a group of facilitators who are from all walks of life and all types of personalities, and you know, it's incredible. It's incredible to watch these people who, you know, they took those first five terrifying steps and were, you know, these tiny little scared people who were quiet and hid, and watching them grow into, you know, people who are not afraid to take up their space in the world and who are happy to help, you know, reach down and help pull other people up from their despair and their smallness and their disconnection and help bring them back into the world. It's a really amazing thing to see. You know, I've met so many fascinating people here, both facilitators and participants, and it's humbling the things I've learned, you know, and hearing other people's stories and just realizing, you know, we're the opposite of alone. There's too many of us, right?
Yeah.
And it's such an isolating experience. But the irony is, like, we're not alone. We're, like, there's too many people who've gone through this experience. And the more we talk about it, both in the gatehouse and you doing a wonderful show like this, and the more we can talk about the experience of abuse and what it does to people and how you can help people, the better off we'll be. It's tragic that people have to live feeling isolated because of such an experience, when most of us are surrounded by people who've had a similar experience. We just don't know because we've all been taught to shut up about it. So I'm feel really empowered seeing so many people who refuse to be quiet about it anymore. Right now, you just can't stop people in this house from talking.
No.
Right?
No, you can't.
It's, you know, the first couple of sessions when people are new, you know, it's a little bit quiet and people are a bit reserved. And once the floodgates open, it's just a never-ending stream of stories and feelings and experiences. And it's really quite humbling.
So where do you see the whole thing, the big picture of sexual abuse awareness going now? This is kind of a loaded mm-hmm. question, if I can put it that way.
Oh yeah, well things are really changing. I mean, I've facilitated a group with, you know, somebody like walked in the door here. I was 43 years old when I first walked in. You know, I'm facilitating somebody who's 22, and the difference in their experience is mind blowing. For example, like I mentioned, when I was 9 years old, I told my family doctor I was being abused, and my doctor was like, oh, we don't talk about that, and just sent me back. And now I talk to, you know, the young man in my group, and his family knows and is really supportive, and like it's there's a different attitude. It's, you know, in a world with so much communication, people are having a harder time pretending it doesn't exist. So
that's changing. It is changing.
It really is changing. And the more of us, I mean, I've become much more open in my life with people about my experience. I mean, I don't overshare, but, you know, like the people at work, you know, I'm like, I don't work Wednesdays because I facilitate here on Wednesdays. And even though I facilitate in the evening, I need the day. You know, it's a heavy experience to facilitate. And I want to come in here with a clear mind and a relaxed mind. And so I've told them, I'm sorry, I do volunteer work on Wednesdays, and so I can't work. And, you know, whereas, you know, it used to be hard to talk about being abused. It was something I would never tell anybody. Now they ask, well, what do you do? And I'm like, I do peer counseling for adult survivors of sexual abuse. And I'm not the slightest bit ashamed to talk about it. So people I work with, people in my social circle, they know the experience I've been through.
Yeah.
And they know that I come here on Wednesdays and I help other people who've been through the same thing. So it's, you know, it's becoming, I mean, the world is slowly changing. I mean, you look, you know, gay marriage is now accepted.
Exactly.
I mean,
in the U.S. now, too.
Yeah. And I mean, 30 years ago, that was not, you know, 30 years ago in Toronto, they were raiding bathhouses and arresting people for being gay.
Yeah.
And now people are getting married at City Hall.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, sexual abuse awareness is on that same kind of arc in terms of, and the thing is, so many people have been abused that once the conversation starts out in public, you know, it's hard to put it back in the bottle once you've opened the bottle, because so many people can relate to the experience. And the more those of us who have had the experience and have found a place where we're comfortable can share, you know, the less this thing will be hidden. And I think and same, like, back when in the 70s, when I told my doctor, and my doctor was like, you know, don't say anything.
Shut up.
You know, now they're legally obliged to do something about it, right? And if a story got out that the doctor was told about the sexual abuse of a child and sent the child back to the home, you know, they would risk losing their license. Like, that's a big change.
Big
back,
change.
Back, and that's, you know, we're talking 30 years, but it's changed that much. And that's not to say people still aren't being abused, because they are.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
But
epidemic portions.
But the ability to reach out for help is getting better. And the more we can all talk about it and share our experiences and get out from under the shame and be like, I'm not ashamed. The person who did this to me should be ashamed. I have nothing to be ashamed of. And, you know, the less isolated people who have been through that experience will feel, and the more comfortable they will feel seeking help, you know, and which is the only way to get through this experience is to find people who've had an experience like yours and talk it out. You know, if you keep it inside you, it'll eat you alive.
So you find, though, for the most part, that the people you have told and the circle of people like you're talking about, you find them to be very supportive?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I have not had a negative reaction yet.
So what kind of reactions do you get when you tell people like that, like in your circle? Like, or you find that the most of them are confounded or just don't really know what to say.
Well, so, some of them don't really know what to say. Some of them, I mean, I've had more than one person, once I've opened up, say,
yeah,
I was abused as well. So there's these connections.
So it's opened up some doors, too.
Absolutely. And it's allowed me to tell people, you know, who could use the gatehouse.
Yeah.
Like, well, look at what this place has done for me.
Yeah.
So we all have to grow at our own speed, but if you ever feel like you could use a safe and comfortable place to help you process this, there are places like the gatehouse that you can go to. So, I mean, some people are a little, they don't know what to say because it's such a big thing, and it's still
very,
even though the world has changed, we don't talk about it actively very much.
No. Right? It's but it is starting to change, and I firmly believe that. You know, we always talk about a shift, right? And I firmly believe the shift is happening now.
Absolutely.
And,
absolutely.
And it's happening at a pretty good level too. And I say by next year, I mean, even this year, I know it's a huge shift in just in society, the media,
mm-hmm.
Basically all around, even internationally,
mm-hmm.
things are changing.
Mm-hmm.
And I often talk about the UK and I often talk about the US,
mm-hmm.
although I primarily try to talk about what happens here in Canada, but I can't help but bring this stuff in because overall it's affecting us here as well. People
mm-hmm.
don't understand, like even with the CSA inquiry, which I've talked about this going on over in the UK right now,
mm-hmm.
it's going to spill in over here.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to spill into the US.
Mm-hmm.
We're all connected, whether we want to be or not.
Yeah.
And people are fed up,
mm-hmm.
and especially lost survivors to begin with, anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a whole, I mean, I've talked to literally hundreds of people, not just here in Canada, but abroad, like in the UK, like I'm talking about, in the US, and we're just fed up.
Mm-hmm.
You know what? We were told, brought up to shut up, and that's not right.
Mm-hmm.
You know? So somebody has to, pardon me, I put a shit to get off the pot, because if this is supposed to be right in society, I'm going to have a little rant here, so it won't take long.
Go for it.
You know, if this was supposed to be all right in society and okay, then why was it done to us and why wasn't it taught that way and why are we so messed up? And never mind just us here, but I mean thousands of other people.
Mm-hmm.
And yet society or government or laws, not just here but abroad in other countries, then you're stuck with us after the fact. We're messed up. What do you, I mean, like, I don't get it. Like,
mm-hmm.
if this is supposed to be acceptable in society, then why wasn't it taught to us?
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it was 1,000 years ago, but it's not being taught to us now.
Mm-hmm.
And from what I understand, when I was abused and whenever I did finally mention it to somebody, I was told to shut up about it,
mm-hmm.
just like yourself.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm confused.
Mm-hmm.
So is it supposed to be all right or not supposed to be all right?
Mm-hmm.
Actually, I'm not confused. I already know what the truth is, but it's just the way I'm ranting about it anyway. It just doesn't make any sense. There's a lot more to it than not just making any sense. I mean, ethically, and if you look at it in a humanistic point of view or just plain for humanity, you just don't do that stuff to your children.
Mm-hmm.
They don't even do that in the animal kingdom. And if they did, usually somebody would kill that animal that did that.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, as humans, as animals, we can't do that.
Yeah.
We do, we're gone to jail for 25 years.
Mm-hmm.
Or we get killed ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
Just for the fact of doing it, right or wrong.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, it's very, you know, I firmly believe we're into a shift now. And I know it's shifting here in Canada. I know it's shifting in the U.S. It's shifting in the U.K. There's a bunch of other countries, but I'm just making reference to the two countries I've seen to communicate with the most.
Yeah.
In regards to this thing. About sexual abuse.
Mm-hmm.
And it keeps going at a much greater level. The momentum is picking up tremendously,
mm-hmm.
From what I see just on multimedia in regards to this issue. And, you know, general consensus, people are just fed up and they don't want to hold the secret anymore because it's basically for most of us that have had to carry this for, you know, for 10, 20, 30, 40, 50, even 60 years.
Mm-hmm.
I've had to deal with this all their lives. Have had basically no quality of life.
Yeah.
You know? And it all falls back to well, if you had said something and taught me about it, I might have been a little bit different, or if it did happen to me and you could have helped me get over it, it'd be a different thing, but society has done nothing.
Yeah.
You know, I can't just blame government, but I'm going to say society. Society
mm-hmm.
has done nothing. They've swept it under the carpet.
Mm-hmm.
But I say no more. And if people like myself and you, like right here now we're talking, and many other people I've met over the last few years, and then some,
mm-hmm.
Are basically on the same page as I am.
Mm-hmm.
And we've had enough, and we want to change that.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm going to keep beating on the street until things change, and I'm going to keep knocking on doors and,
mm-hmm.
and talking about it, whether they want to hear about it or not. I'm not afraid to say who I am,
mm-hmm.
where I'm coming from, and if people can't handle it, well, I'm sorry, that's
yeah.
just too bad, right? Because I'm not going to shut up about it. And this is one of the great things about our country anyway, is that we have the freedom to say, you know, freedom of speech, right?
Yeah.
You know, it's built in our Constitution.
Yeah.
So if I'm going to get thrown in jail for saying what I'm talking about, that would have been done a long time ago.
Yeah.
Excuse me. But then on the other hand, I talked to other people from other countries, like the UK, for example. There's a lot of people who are very upfront, and they'll talk about they're not afraid to say the name in their face. But I've met a lot of people that are not are afraid to say the face. They're afraid of being backlash, you know, the old The stigma, such as I know, well, just because you were abused means you're going to be abused as well. That's not the case, really.
No.
And I've said statistics before. I don't statistically speaking, even in Canada, if you've been abused, the chances of you abusing somebody else are like less than 1%.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very, very small percentage. And look at the offenders. You know, look at people in jail. A lot of jails are full of people that have been sexually abused, but they weren't offenders themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Like I say, the percentage of people that reoffend, or rather that offend after being offended, is very, very minimal.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing too, just because you were I'll say violated instead. It's much better, sits better with me. And it doesn't mean that if you were violated that you're going to be gay,
mm-hmm.
or you're going to be a lesbian. It doesn't
mm-hmm.
mean that either.
Mm-hmm.
So there's all kinds of different stigmas that go on top of that.
Yeah.
And you know, and it all falls back to no education.
Mm-hmm.
People don't understand. They don't get it. And they just, you know, they assume that this is what's going to happen to you just because that happened to you.
Mm-hmm.
And they, you know, they stereotype or judge you,
mm-hmm.
and not really knowing the facts.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why I'm really happy you're here sharing this and talking about this with me as well.
I'm happy
and,
to be here.
And I, like I say, it's shifting. It is really, really shifting. And with you being here, you're going to help shift it some more.
Yeah, and it's funny you mentioned, you know, prisons. It's one of the things I'd like to do in the long term is find a way to introduce a program like there is at the Gatehouse into the prison system. Because so many people who've ended up in jail have ended up there because they have been broken by abuse.
Yeah.
And they are isolated and lash out with anger and violence, and it all stems from, you know, I would say many people who've ended up in jail as violent offenders were abused as children.
Yeah, and you're absolutely right.
And there aren't, these kind of programs don't exist in our prison system.
They don't.
These kind of peer support groups
no.
do not exist
yeah.
in our prison system. And it's only been luck that I didn't end up there. And I think, you know, when I get a little further along in my journey, I would like to take this kind of program and take it into the prison system.
Well, one thing I'll share with you, Steve, I've been very, very fortunate, and this is what I'm thinking, one thing I'm really grateful about the Gatehouse is I do a lot of one-on-ones aside from doing groups. And one thing I have done is I've done one-on-ones with some really bad people.
Mm-hmm.
And I haven't gone into the prison system, but I've had people come out of the prison system, and I've dealt with them. And I'd be really honored to be able to do that,
mm-hmm.
because these guys know that they could trust or anybody who believes in them.
Yeah.
And that's a big thing. It's a huge thing. If nobody believes in them,
mm-hmm.
you know, not never mind just believing that they were abused, but just believes in them as a person, that they're a human being, just like you and I are.
Mm-hmm.
And that really bothers me,
mm-hmm.
you know, because like, again, it all falls back to, you know, no education in regards to what's really going on.
Mm-hmm.
And so, therefore, it just falls back to a stereotype and so-called judgment that's totally unfounded without any real facts
mm-hmm.
or anything in regards to why and what happened, right? It just
yeah.
doesn't make any system. It's just, it can be such a big, nasty system sometimes.
Yeah.
But we are getting close to time, so how about we do another song and then we'll close off for the night?
That sounds good. Speaking of jails and stuff, I think I have a song that's rather appropriate.
Okay, great.
This one's called Sunshine Sink. Hey, Mr. Judge, hear my plea. I'm a guilty man, don't ever, ever set me free. I'm a sunshine saint sinner when the night time comes. Keep your eye on me when the sun goes down. When the sun goes down, that's when trouble comes around. When trouble comes to town, I can never let her down. Oh no, after the sun goes down. Thank you.
Hey, pretty girl, don't act surprised. I told you when the moon comes out, I ain't so shy. I'm a sunshine saint sinner when the nighttime comes. Keep your eye on me when the sun goes down. When the sun goes down, that's when trouble comes around. When trouble comes to town, I can never let her down. No, no, after the sun goes down. Hey, Mr. Judge, how could I know? That pretty girl was yours, I guess it's back to jail I go. I'm a sunshine saint sinner when the nighttime comes. Keep your eye on me when the sun goes down. When the sun goes down, that's when trouble comes around. When trouble comes to town, I can never let her down. No, no, after the sun goes down. Thank you, Stuart.
Thank you. Thank you ever so much. So, any last thoughts before we close off for tonight?
You know, just want to say to anybody who's listening, you know, your voice is valid. Your voice is worthwhile. And, you know, there's no reason to feel alone. We're all in this together. You know, you and I are here in this room. The house above us is filled. It's filled. People who
men and women both.
Men and women both. Who've been through this experience, and it does feel isolating, and it does feel scary, and it does feel like you're alone, but you're not. We're all here. There are places to go and find others like yourself, and that healing journey, that transformation is within all of our grasp. We just have to find our voices and find others like ourselves to talk this out with. And I really, really appreciate being invited on the show today.
Thank you. Will you come back again?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah, anytime. We'll have to do this again. Maybe we'll do this by the fall or something, or before. Yeah, absolutely.
Sounds great.
I want to see how far, see if anything else has changed.
Oh, I am sure it will. Yeah. I'm sure it will.
So I'm going to kind of close off. I've got a few things to say. Is there any way you can kind of play a little bit in the background here while I'm talking? Is that possible?
Yeah, I could do a little something, I guess.
As I kind of close off here,
yeah.
I'm going to say a few things.
Yeah.
If you kind of just a little bit
in the
background.
I will. I'll play
that's
quiet.
Great. Thank you. Thanks again, Steve. I'm really, really grateful.
Anytime.
Okay, so folks, I should give another reminder. We still have some open space. We're having our partners group coming up, which will be next Saturday, August the 8th. And we still have some opening spots. So if anybody's interested, couples, and let me be quite specific, it doesn't matter. It could be your best friend. It doesn't really matter. Come as two, and we can help your friend or rather your intimate partner or your friend. Help them understand your growth that you received here at the Gatehouse, and you know it's just good understanding after all it'll help both sides. All I know is it's good personal growth for both of you to come here anyway. We have some open spots still. August the 8th, I'm broadcasting live to Gatehouse here with Steve at 3101 Lakeshore Boulevard West in Toronto, or Old Etobicoke, as I like to say. It's a beautiful hot summer's evening. Oh, 70 degrees outside. It's beautiful. Having it rain quite a while. It's kind of nice. We've had a lot of rain. But it's beautiful. And the weekend looking good. We're coming into our civic holiday. So the Gatehouse will be closed Monday, although myself and Deb will be here because we have a group going on. But other than that, the house is closed. And we'll be open up through the week next week. And what else have I got to say? Yes. I cannot forget this. I have to thank Red Light Sports Network. And if you hashtag Red Light Sports, last Sunday around 6 o'clock, Troy, the broadcaster from there, he gave me an interview, and we talked about the Gatehouse, my personal transformation, where I am now. I have to thank you, Troy. Thank you ever so much for giving me the opportunity to be the other way around versus me interviewing somebody else. So, folks, have a great week. And remember, this is only peer support. I'm not a doctor or physician or anything of the sort. If you feel triggered, please seek out some help. And most importantly, take care of yourselves. It's all about self-care here. So have a great week, and we'll talk to you next week. Thank you for your time. And Steve, thank you ever so much.
Anytime.
Love you, man. That's it.